So, good evening and welcome to our last Tuesday gathering of our practice period. So, what we're going to do this evening is I'm going to do a summary of the four talks that we've heard, and then we're going to have a Dharma discussion, and then we're going to end with the precepts and the refuges. So, we'll see if any of this sounds familiar. Night number one.
where's your prop?
My whoopee cushion?
Yeah.
No, that was night number two. Yes, so you're just, okay. Oh, that would have been so great. I have to tell you, we don't have it, do we?
Don't have it.
Okay. Night number one, what is a practice? So we started by sort of, this is the first time we've done a practice period in Bellingham Insight. So we define it as a time to deepen and clarify our practice, both on the cushion and off the cushion. And when the teaching core came up with this idea, we really were looking at our practice not only as individuals, but our practice within a community, within a sangha. And that's why we built in the Dharma discussions each week, so that we would actually have a chance to talk to each other and get to know each other and get to know each other's practices. So that was sort of part of our vision or our intention for this month and a bit. So after defining practice period, we looked at three foundational kind of teachings that could serve as inspiration for our practice period, and those things were the idea of intention, the precepts, and the refuges. And we're going to look at the precepts and the refuges at the end of our evening, but I wanted just to review this idea of intention, because the Buddha said that our intentions are the main factors in shaping our lives. So it seemed like a good place to start. So if we think of intention as sort of the stretching or bending of our mind in a direction, then setting your intention is setting a direction for a moment or your life. So, you know, in the short term, you might say my intention is to focus on my breath, or to, like, say, to follow the instructions that Steve gave at the beginning of our meditation period. But you can also say, what is my deepest wish? What is my intention in my life? What am I yearning for or leaning towards? And so exploring that kind of intention seemed like a good place to begin for a practice period. So we looked at, or at least noted, a couple practices that could help with intention. And the practice of generosity and the practice of virtue, which are the precepts. And we looked at replacing unskillful intentions with skillful ones. And we looked at the idea that we could examine our actions at the beginning, in the middle, and the end to see if they met our hope for skillful intention. So, and the last thing we talked about was that actually meditation is an excellent basis for intention, because it allows the mind to settle and the mind to clear, so that we're a little bit more able to actually see what our intention might be and then to work more skillfully in that direction. So, we looked at this quote from Ajahn Jeff, who said something like, the road... there's this phrase, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And he said, well, that's not actually true. The road to hell is paved with poorly thought out intentions, and good intentions could take you in a different direction. And so really being on the cushion and allowing the mind to settle allows us to, you know, to have a little bit better idea whether we're on the road to hell or the road to heaven. So it seemed like a good thing. So the next Tuesday, John talked about the six sense doors, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, touch, and the mind. And there was that memorable whoopee cushion moment. So I asked each of the facilitators for the 2, 3, and 4 to give me their idea of the summary. So what I'm going to read now is John's summary of the Sense Door talk. Although it feels as if we are looking out onto the world through clear glass, the external objects we come into contact with merely trigger the process of perception. It's our minds that actually create the world we experience, the sounds, the sights, etc. Our momentary mental events that exist only in our consciousness. And these sense experiences are profoundly influenced by our emotions, our expectations, our motivations, and our beliefs. Yet we often attribute the qualities of these mind-made sense experiences to the external objects. And because the mind is under the delusion that I am the experiencer, we identify with sense experiences and allow them to feed our craving and our sense of self. And so we attribute meaning and significance to the objects that trigger those experiences, projecting our own value judgments like beautiful, irritating, sad onto them, as if these were actual qualities of the objects themselves. We then become the victims of these distorted perceptions, and we suffer. So if we wish to free ourselves from suffering, we must train the mind to see through this self-deception and experience the world as the Buddha described in the Bahiya Sutta, when he says, when in the seen is merely what is seen, when in the heard is merely what is heard, when in the sensed is merely what is sensed, just this is the end of suffering. So with that overview, we then broke into groups and I think gave each other examples of how the sense impressions we took in led to perceptions that often took us in directions that weren't particularly helpful or confusing or whatever. So that was week 2. I bet some of you missed it and really wish you were there. So our third Tuesday, Steve and Mary talked about tools for dealing with anxiety and depression from the Buddhist toolkit. So the first tool that Steve talked about was loving kindness. Loving kindness being the number one tool in the toolkit for anxiety and depression. So loving kindness or metta is the practice of sending good wishes to self and others. And Steve and Mary suggested some phrases. May I be well and happy. May I be free from suffering, unease, grief, worry, and anger. May I see humor and lightness in everyday situations. May I be strong, self-confident, healthy, and peaceful. Then Steve talked about a story in the suttas with the metaphor of multiple arrows, where the pain you feel, physical or emotional, is the first arrow. And then as you layer on more suffering, that is, you add judgment or a story or project this moment into the past or the future, as if you're stabbing yourself with multiple arrows. So he said, depression and anxiety may epitomize those multiple arrows more than any other suffering we experience. We may feel low, maybe through brain chemistry, maybe through hearing the news of an injury or a loss. Arrow one. Then the guilt, reliving the event, the imaginings, the stories, the unworthiness, the growing monster we construct. Arrow, arrow, arrow. Those are arrows that we can do something about. So Steve and Mary discussed some techniques for easing the suffering of those mental states based on the Buddha's discourse on right effort, and then mentioned many other ideas, whether Buddhist or not, that we use, and they handed out a list. And then Mary put a document out that people could actually add to. Is it still addable? Is it still out there? Yeah, okay. So.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the The link was in that email, and I know a few people edited a few things and added a few things.
Great. Thanks. And then last week, John and Carolyn talked about illusions of self, the Buddhist concept of anatta. And so this is their summary. The Buddha said, nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine. And the one thing we cling to most, end quote, and the one thing we cling to most is our idea of self. We create stress or dukkha in our lives by habitually reinforcing the illusion of self through our thoughts, words, concepts, opinions, judgments, and personal internal stories in daily life. The core of suffering, dukkha, is living in a world of thoughts and imaginations of self and believing ourselves that is what is, when in fact we are removed from the direct experience. We are out of sync, not in harmony. Through mindful awareness and reflection, we can let go of this habit of mind that clings to concepts, ideas, and emotional states as if they are what is, and discover direct moments of freedom. So then John and Carolyn asked, what is this experience of no self like? And they said, it can often feel disconcerting or fearful at first because of our strong habit of mind to remain deluded. In awareness, self-image exists, but is not identified or clinging to it as I or mine. In awareness, self is an ever-changing flow or process, not a fixed or static state. And then John added, remember, one does not need to get rid of self since self never really existed, rather like an image seen in a mirror. So, actually, you know, when we put it together, I thought, you know, this actually kind of hangs together. There actually look like there's some themes in here, which I'm not sure was actually clear at the beginning. So in the course of this time, we looked at intention, the refuges, the precepts, sense doors and perception, tools for dealing with anxiety and depression, and concepts of self. So as we know, the Buddha had many strategies and many ideas for dealing with just about everything. And there's sort of a temptation to keep trying a lot of stuff. So what we decided to do tonight was, one, to summarize what we actually had picked out so it would have a chance to sort of settle. And then we thought we would talk to each other about what actually settled for us. So we're going to divide into triads again. And then I'll give you a clearer picture of what it is we're going to decide. So if you would divide into threes, and we'll see how that goes in terms of our numbers. And, you know, if you want to walk across the room because you haven't talked to someone and you want to, that's fine too. We might have to. 1, 2, 3. What we learned before is we don't really need topics in order to talk to each other. So let's see. 1, 2, 3. And then, all right, there's three of you. 3, 3, 3. And a happy foursome. Okay. Okay. So before we start, take a moment to quiet down, to settle back into your body. Breathing in, breathing out. allowing your tension to settle into your body, letting some of that energy fall out of your head into your body. Considering speaking and listening with all of your sense doors, not just your mind, listening with your body, speaking with your body. So, this is the discussion question. The Buddha had many teachings and many strategies. Practicing with one or two intentions over a period of time is often more useful than continually trying out all the options. So, take a moment to think about what was the most useful practice that you tried or committed to during this period, or the most interesting topic you explored, or kind of what grabbed your attention or your heart. And talk about the ways in which it was useful or meaningful. And then if you have time, we're going to do this 3 minutes a piece. You might consider what your intention might be for the next month or the next 3 months. So what grabbed your heart or your spirit in this last month, and what might you be thinking about doing in the next month or whatever? So, first person.
Jean and I met a couple of weeks ago, and just kind of were brainstorming about how to spend this last evening together at the practice period. And since we knew we'd be finishing it by taking refuge and also taking the precepts, thought that it might be useful to just sort of put that into context and say a few words about why it's important and how it's relevant to the practice. I think, myself included, there are many people who think about taking refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha as just kind of a devotional gesture that maybe isn't that relevant to the practice. Maybe something that people in the East do, and maybe something that people in the West, you know, are above. Or at least I kind of felt that way. I realize now it's just because I was really ignorant of the really important role that it does play in the practice. The precepts not so much, obviously, since that's kind of like the foundation of the Eightfold Path. I mean, sila, ethical behavior, moral discipline, that's like the foundation of it all. So that was pretty clear. But I just happened to be reading a book by Ayakema called When the Iron Eagle Flies. And it's all about what's called, this is a name that's surely going to turn you off, but Transcendental Dependent Arising, which is kind of the positive sort of causal chain versus the one that we're probably all more familiar with, which is just sort of the usual dependent arising, where we have this 12-link causal chain of, you know, starting with ignorance and then karma making, consciousness, and, you know, going all the way through feeling and craving and clinging and becoming and birth and then old age, sickness and death and suffering. And that's the one that most of us are familiar with. And it that one ends with suffering, so it's kind of a downer. But Transcendental Dependent Arising is really outlining the stages of the spiritual path. And it begins with suffering, which motivates everything else, and ends with, you know, what we're all searching for, which is, you know, awakening, liberation, the end of suffering. So I'm just going to talk about a couple links in that chain of transcendental dependent arising. Again, those particular stages in the spiritual path that we all take if we embark on the Buddhist path. Again, it begins with and then how taking refuge and taking the precepts, what part they play in those links. So it begins with suffering, and it really, we have no motivation to take a spiritual path unless we are convinced that the way that we usually live life is not going to lead to a lasting, reliable happiness. If we're still kind of holding out hope that we're finally going to get all the pieces together, you know, find the right partner, get just the right job, move to a warmer, sunnier climate, you know, put it all together, and then I'll finally, you know, have it, you know, I'll be happy. If we're always holding out hope that that's going to happen, we have little motivation to start off on a spiritual path. But if we eventually, you know, some of us with half a century of experience come to the conclusion that it's just never going to happen that way, and that instead of seeking for my happiness out there in the objects of the world, it's going to have to come from here inside, then we understand the nature of suffering, and we can renounce the world as, or life as we've been living it, and we can embark on the spiritual path. And so that takes us then to the next stage. If we're going to embark on a spiritual path, we have to have a spiritual path, so how to choose one. We're given some guidance about how to do that in the suttas, this is guidance that would be applicable to any path that we'd be looking at. We look at the teacher, and we look at the teachings, and then we look at the disciples, people who have followed this path and where it's led them, who they've become. And that just happens to be the Buddha, the teacher, the teachings, Dhamma, and the disciples, the Sangha, the noble ones. So that's our triple gem. These are the our guides that we accept, that we place our confidence in when we take refuge. So when we're scrutinizing a potential spiritual path, we look at these and we say, you know, is the teacher trustworthy? What qualities does he embody? Do his words and actions demonstrate that he was truly awakened? We look at the teachings. What qualities of mind is this particular practice meant to induce? Are the teachings internally consistent? Do they strike us personally as truthful or meaningful? And then we look at the disciples, the Sangha. Do they seem reliable? Do they seem to embody qualities that we, you know, value? Were they able to overcome the kind of obstacles that we are going to face in our practice? And where did it lead them? Did they become honorable and admirable people? And so we can do this sort of investigation by reading the teachings. There's some, you know, wonderful books. For instance, John Robinson, one of his favorite books he told me is this book called The Disciples of the Buddha. I think that's what it's called. It's in the Wisdom Teachings of the Buddha series. So he loves it, and he finds it very inspirational. So we can sort of look at the Sangha, the noble ones, by doing that kind of reading. We have all the Dhamma talks in the world on the internet. We can, you know, get a whole library full of books. We can investigate the teachings and the life of the Buddha by reading and listening to Dhamma talks. But as Steve pointed out, the most important kind of investigation is giving it a try ourselves and seeing if it's giving us some ease, some contentment, some happiness. Does it seem to be moving us in a direction that we want to go? And if it does, then the next stage in this causal chain, the next stage in the spiritual path, just kind of naturally arises, and that's faith and confidence. When we have faith and confidence of the kind I just described, that's kind of like an intellectual scrutinizing of the Buddha, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. But when we have real faith and confidence, when it deepens, and when we're sort of making a practice of recollecting the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and really contemplating what they have given us, where we have gone by following the practice up to now, who they really were, and the promise of us sort of becoming even a little bit like them. It goes from being an intellectual exercise to one that's sort of imbued with feeling and devotion and inspiration, and becomes a source of joy. And joy is the next step on in that causal chain. It's the next step in our spiritual practice. So we start with an understanding of suffering, dukkha, which leads us to faith and confidence in the spiritual practice that we've embarked on to liberate ourselves from dukkha. And that faith and confidence, when it deepens, when it ripens, that leads to real joy. And so when we take the refuges, when we take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, it's good to keep that in mind, that these are the objects that we have placed our confidence in. This is a source of inspiration and a source of joy. And then another source of joy is ethical, moral, wholesome behavior, which comes from taking the precepts, following the precepts. And the precepts are usually sort of seen as abstaining from various kinds of activity, abstaining from taking life, from taking what's not given, from sexual misconduct, abstaining from false and harmful speech, and consuming intoxicants. But there's a sort of a more positive way of looking at it, and Bhikkhu Bodhi, in his book on transcendental dependent arising, states that it's implicit in the practice of moral ethical conduct, is that in addition to abstaining from these behaviors, we will also be cultivating wholesome behaviors that are kind of the flip side of each one. So as we abstain from taking life, we develop compassion for all living things. As we abstain from not taking what is given, what is not given, we develop honesty. As we abstain from sexual misconduct, we develop purity, a as we abstain from dishonest or harmful speech, we develop truthfulness. And as we abstain from taking intoxicants, we develop heedfulness, constant mindfulness and alertness. So these become a real source of joy in the practice as well. There's a wonderful book by Ajahn Jeff called A Meditator's Toolkit. Meditator's Tools. Study Guide to the 10 Recollections. And these are things that we should occasionally remember in order to arouse joy and inspiration. Because joy and inspiration are what will really allow us to settle into our practice, achieve deep states of serenity and concentration, which is the next step in the spiritual path. Aya Kema, in her book, she's vehement about, you know, how joy is absolutely necessary on the path. And so any way that we can arouse this joy, we should take full advantage of that. And I kind of had a taste of that. Before I say that, just to make clear again. So taking the precepts and cultivating wholesome behavior. Every once in a while recalling that, you know, our conduct is beyond reproach. We are developing purity and honesty and compassion, and these are virtues that, you know, are good and laudable, and remembering that, and remembering specific instances of when we behaved in those ways should be sources of joy. And just like with generosity, that sort of ethical behavior is something that we should always try and be conscious of when we're doing it and after. Because we owe it to ourselves to be conscious of that and allow it to make us happy, to bring us joy. Because again, as Aya Kema says, that joy is essential in the practice. And unless we have joy, our practice is always going to be half-hearted. It's going to be more difficult for us to make the time to sit on the cushion. And even when we do sit on the cushion, we're going to be distracted, and we're going to always be interrupted by thoughts and agitation and doubt. But if we've got joy within us, if we've really worked to cultivate joy within us, then we can settle in, and we can be certain that this is the best of all things I could be doing right now. And just one time when I really tasted that was at Ajahn Santi's retreat in Samish last fall, or the fall before last, when he sort of guided us in a metta meditation. And he asked us to recall a time when we acted with love and compassion towards someone. And so I remembered when I was just finishing up a visit back home in Minnesota and saying goodbye to my sister at the airport. She had just kind of been agitated and on edge for the entire visit. And yet we never really had an opportunity to talk, and I never really had an opportunity to find out what that was all about. So when I was saying goodbye to her at the airport next to her car, I saw that agitated look in her eyes, and I just went up to her and gave her a hug. And you know, we usually hug and say goodbye, but I let this one linger, and I just whispered in her ear, I always wish you well. And I could sort of feel her tense a bit and start sort of pushing away, but I just held her. And then I could just sort of feel her letting go. And then she started to cry. And she proceeded to tell me what was going on, and it just seemed to bring her a lot of relief. And I just was really happy that I saw that she was hurting, and that I really felt like I wanted to do something to ease that for her, and that it worked, and brought us closer, brought her a little bit of ease and comfort, and I took the time to show compassion to someone, and it seems strange that we kind of pat ourselves on the back for that, but that's exactly what we should do. We should remember when we've acted in good ways, when we've been good people, when we've been when the results of our practice have really shown, because that, as it did at the retreat when I was recalling all this, will just fill us with joy. And it did. I mean, I had to sort of keep from crying with joy at the retreat because there were lots of people around me. But it then allowed me to settle into this sort of deep state of serenity and deep concentration that I had never felt before. And that then, will take us all the way eventually if we can really make a habit of that. Anyway, joy comes from keeping the precepts and cultivating wholesome mental states. Joy comes from recalling the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha and what they have given to us, and the fact that we have this wonderful opportunity to practice this particular path, which we have faith in and which we're confident that will take us all the way eventually if we really practice wholeheartedly without indecision. And so when we take refuge and when we take the precepts, maybe that's something to keep in mind, that it's extremely relevant to the practice. Thanks. I'm sorry that took so long.
I don't think anyone else is sorry. Thank you very much. So we are going to take the refuges and the precepts, and if for some reason it would feel dishonest or it just is not something you feel comfortable doing, you don't have to say it out loud. Or if there's one precept that you're thinking, I'm just not ready to say this, don't. I mean, it's fine. So for the refuges, I think we can say them together. They're pretty straightforward, and they do repeat. So taking refuge. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. For the second time, I take refuge in the Buddha. For the second time, I take refuge in the Dharma. For the second time, I take refuge in the Sangha. For the third time, I take refuge in the Buddha. For the third time, I take refuge in the Dharma. For the third time, I take refuge in the Sangha. So for the precepts, I'll say each one and then we'll say it together. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. I undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. I undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. I undertake the precept to refrain from false and harmful speech.
I undertake the precept to refrain from false and harmful speech.
I undertake the precept to refrain from consuming intoxicating drink and drugs which lead to heedlessness.
I undertake the precept to refrain from consuming intoxicating drink and drugs which lead to heedlessness.
It is a good feeling to take precepts and refuges with Sangha. It's nice to look around and think we are practicing together. So thank you all. I think with this we'll conclude our practice period, and hopefully it won't be our last one, and it certainly won't be the end of our practice. So good night.
Thank you.